When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Attention all personnel. Please clear the launching area.
Fire, fire.
Oh, baby. I'll give it to you.
That was really good.
Yes, it does. It's dead on.
Okay, keep the chatter down in this room.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set, yeah.
Welcome to a special December/November 2023 edition of the Space Boffins podcast. We're in partnership with The Naked Scientists, and I'm Richard Hollingham.
And I'm Sue Nelson. And if you thought our last double astronaut podcast couldn't be bettered, well, we've a treat for you. An interview that's never been broadcast in full, a conversation with a legendary astronaut, Frank Borman, who passed away last month. Age 95. Colonel Borman was the commander of Gemini 7 in 1965, a 14-day mission in the tiny Gemini spacecraft, but he's best known as commander of the first manned mission to the moon. Apollo 8 launched 55 years ago, December 1968, the first time astronauts had flown on the giant Saturn V rocket. A few days later, the crew, Borman, Jim Lovell and Bill Anders, captured the famous Earthrise image as they orbited the moon, and they read from the Book of Genesis on Christmas Eve. Their return to Earth was the fastest anyone had ever travelled.
5 years ago, to mark the 50th anniversary of Apollo 8, I made a BBC radio programme called Message from the Moon. And in partnership with the BBC World Service, Witness History programme was fortunate enough to interview Frank Borman. Now, we used audio and video clips of the interview in both programmes. That was the nature of the programmes. We were just after these clips were just Frank Borman speaking. But we've never played the whole interview in full.
And that's great, because what people are going to hear is effectively an exclusive, because when you make radio programmes, you can only use edited highlights, basically, which often means, as you know, you have to leave some amazing stuff on the sort of the audio equivalent of the cutting room floor. So to have a full conversation with Frank Borman that's really detailed and interesting, and my goodness, what a guy, 95, hearing, you know, he's so on the ball. It is a treat. It's definitely a treat.
I should do a little bit of a setup here.
Okay.
So firstly, should say Frank Borman didn't do many interviews, so we were really lucky to get this interview. Well, not
your
lucky.
Charm, maybe.
It was a combination of many people's charm, I have to say. Okay. I also should credit producer Simon Watts for this. So we did a huge amount of preparation. We spent a day preparing the questions, because he has a bit of a reputation, Frank Borman. He's a little bit scary. So we were determined to not get our facts wrong. And I should also say that we were in a studio in London, and he was in a hotel in Montana with a sound engineer and with a cameraman. He's a little deaf. He had communication issues. We had communication issues. And so there are points in this interview where it sounds like I'm just shouting at him. Because I was shouting at him.
It does sound like you're talking to the hard of hearing sometimes. But that's
that wasn't his fault. It was the communication was pretty poor at points, because we were connected on, I think this was probably on Skype or something. It was just insane. Anyway, so the conversation doesn't always flow. But that aside.
Don't even say that. It does flow. It sounds great. Anyway, that's enough of the setup. We'll chat more about it afterwards. But here in full is that rather wonderful interview with Colonel Frank Borman.
Apollo Saturn launch control at 3 hours, 21 minutes, 27 seconds and counting. The spacecraft test conductor now has given a go for crew departure. We expect that astronauts Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders will be coming out in a matter of a few minutes. This is Launch Control.
We were the first crew on a Saturn V, but the Saturn V had two unmanned tests before that. It was really a remarkable machine. It still is the most powerful machine ever made by man. 7.5 million pounds of thrust at liftoff. It was burning fuel at a prodigious weight. I think it was something like 5,000 gallons a second, if I remember. It's been a long time ago. But it was a very impressive machine.
And what was the launch like? Can you describe that?
We have ignition sequence start. The engines are on. 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have commit. We have liftoff.
At launch, the noise was extremely loud. We had not been able to train for that, really. For the first couple of minutes, communication between the crew was almost impossible. There was also the usual shaking and rattling around of a launch vehicle. Jim and I had experienced that in the Gemini launch vehicle. But the Saturn V was more of everything. Much louder, a lot more vibration and shakiness, although the G-forces were less. As I recall, in the first stage, we only got about 4 Gs, which is really not very many. But it was such a big machine that it didn't accelerate nearly as fast as the Titan did on our Gemini flight.
And you said you could hardly communicate. How much vibration was there? How much feeling of power was there?
Well, we felt, at least I felt, like we were on the point of a needle, a very large needle. And the tip of the needle, obviously, the vibrations are accentuated up there. So it was, I had a feeling of being along for the ride rather than being in control of anything.
You mentioned the tests beforehand. They had not gone well. Were you concerned? Were you worried?
The first test of the Saturn V had done very well. The second test did not do very well. There were engines shut down, and it was an unsatisfactory test. But I had a lot of confidence in the NASA engineers and in the team at Huntsville, and we went over all the fixes that they put in the booster. And honestly, I was quite confident of the Saturn V. As a matter of fact, I was quite confident of the Apollo spacecraft, too. Bill Anders had figured that he had, 30% of a mission success, 30% of getting back, and 30% of dying. I never felt that way. I felt we'd be back for sure at 100%, and I thought we'd do the mission.
Just coming back to that, you said only 4 Gs. Can you just give a sense of what that is like?
Yes, when you're launched or when you re-enter, you're accelerating, and the G-force, you multiply the number of Gs by your weight, and you can tell how much you weigh. I suppose in the spacesuit, I must have come close to 200 pounds. So 4 Gs, that would mean in reality, I weighed 800 pounds. And it gets very hard to breathe, almost impossible to raise your arms or to do any sort of a motion with your body. You also, your eyes flatten out, so you get like tunnel vision. It's an unusual feeling.
And what is it like when that ends, when you're suddenly released from that force?
We were at about 4 Gs when the staging occurred, and the staging, the five big engines on the Saturn V cut off, and then went from 4 Gs to zero Gs for an instant, and we were thrown forward in our suits and against the safety belts. Then the second stage cut in, and we were thrown right back again. So it was a violent maneuver from the standpoint of the crew and from the standpoint of the spacecraft.
In terms of just going back before the launch, can you just explain what the aim of this Apollo 8 mission was and its importance?
Well, the Apollo 8 mission was designed to, I think you'd say, bring together all of the works and studies that had been done in the years before about going to the moon. We were to simulate in its entirety, the spacecraft mission, which is to enter a lunar orbit and then come home with a surface propulsion engine. We didn't have a lunar module, But the idea of deep space navigation, circumlunar navigation, trying to understand what the mass cons were on the lunar surface that caused the orbits of other unmanned vehicles to wobble, and then reentering the atmosphere at 25,000 miles an hour. None of that had ever been done before. So we were sort of the trailblazers in that aspect.
And, I mean, the crucial thing was that this was for the first time people, men, were leaving low Earth orbit.
That's correct. This was the first time that anybody had gone. I think that Pete Conrad got up to about 850 miles above on one of the Gemini flights. But, of course, we went 240,000 miles all the way to the moon.
Can you give us a sense of how important this mission was in order to land on the moon by the end of the decade?
Well, our mission had been changed from a Earth orbital mission and moved to a lunar orbital mission and moved ahead by 4 months. And we only had 4 months to train for this new mission. And the basic reason for that was that the CIA had informed NASA that they thought the Russians were going to have a circumlunar flight before the end of the year. Everyone forgets that the Apollo program was basically a battle in the Cold War. It wasn't a voyage of exploration or scientific discovery. It was a political battle in the Cold War. We were obliged to change the mission in order to accomplish the landing before the end of the decade that President Kennedy had promised.
And to what extent did you feel that you were a soldier in that battle, if you like?
Well, I thought that we were Cold War warriors. Fortunately, we weren't involved in shooting, but we were, in my opinion, the mission was extremely important, not only to the U.S., but to free people everywhere.
How much of a risk was it to make Apollo 8 a moon mission?
Well, Apollo 8 was an important mission for the lunar landing, but you got to remember all of them were. If Apollo 7 hadn't been successful, we'd have never been able to fly Apollo 8. Apollo 9 proved the lunar module. Apollo 10 proved it around the moon. So this was a very detailed and sequential series of events. And Apollo 8 was important, but so was 7, so was 9, and so was 10.
What was your reaction when you heard that you were going to be flying the first mission around the moon?
I was working with the spacecraft out in California when I got a call from my boss, Steve Slayton, to get back to Houston because he had something to talk over with me. And he couldn't do it over the phone. So I got an airplane, flew back to Houston. He got me into his... I knew something was different because he closed the door behind me. And then he told me about the Soviet plans and about the change in the mission. And I was delighted. One in the hands were two in the bush. And our mission was... next year, after another one, so I was very pleased. And when I told Jim, and I knew Bill and Jim would be excited about it too, it was a happy event.
Now, you were flying just with the command and service module, so no lander. If that engine had failed, you would have been stuck in orbit around the moon. There was no way out. Did you think that through?
The service propulsion engine, of course, had been tested many, many times, and it's true. Had it failed, I'd still be circling the moon, but and that's not a desirable effect. But nevertheless, look, I had studied that spacecraft and the procedures so many times that I had absolute confidence in the vehicle and in the team that put it together. Chris Kraft, who was the mission director, the director of flight operations, was one of the great heroes of the American space race. He's the only one still alive. And, you know, when Chris said something, I believed it. And I was, I'd like to tell you that I was trembling, but I wasn't. I was confident it was going to work.
Now, you've reached Earth orbit. How much was there a sense of occasion or anticipation in pressing the button to head to the moon?
After the Saturn V had put us in orbit, we discarded the first two stages. The third stage remained with us. And then after we'd gone around them once and a half, they relit the third stage of the Saturn V. It had a single S2 engine of 200,000 pound thrust. And I think it burned for quite a while, but it got us up to the escape trajectory of 25,000 miles an hour. At 25,000 miles an hour, you escape the Earth's gravity and you're on your way to the moon. This particular rocket stage was very, very smooth. It was almost low G, not very much fast acceleration, but smooth and right on track.
That journey from the Earth to the moon, what was that like inside the capsule with the three of you in that closed space?
Well, the Apollo spacecraft, by our standards, was very spacious. Even though there were only three seats, you could sleep under the seats, and it was quite comfortable. The interesting thing is when you get beyond the Earth some distance, you look out one window and you can see the sun, and look out the other window, it's completely dark. We had the other factor of, in order to equalize the thermal load on the spacecraft, we went positioned it perpendicular to the sun and then rolled it slowly. So we call it barbecuing. We did that in order to keep the thermal load equal around the spacecraft. But we really barbecued our way to the moon.
I gather you experienced some sickness that worried the mission controllers on the ground.
Yes, after I'd been up for quite a while, and I got nauseated and threw up. I blamed it at that time on a 24-hour flu or a Seconal tablet that I'd taken to try to get some sleep. I think now it was probably a space adaptation, although I flew 14 days on Gemini and never had a hint of it. The difference being, in Gemini, you couldn't move around. You were sitting in a seat for 14 days. Here, when you moved around, your hearing, your balance was impacted. I recovered quite rapidly, and I think there was, you know, the doctors like to make a big thing of it. They always wanted to have a position of power in this program, and basically, it went away quickly.
Is there a part of that that astronauts never want to admit being ill as well?
Well, I don't mind admit being ill to anybody, except I didn't want, as I said, the doctors were trying to assume a position of more importance than they really deserved in this program. And I could just see them saying, oh, we're going to cancel this now because Borman's sick. That's what bothered me. In other words, I didn't trust the doctors.
Could you just describe getting into lunar orbit and what that involves?
Well, we were aiming, the moon, of course, is moving as orbiting around the Earth about, I think it's about 3,000 miles an hour. And as I recall, we were going around 2,000 miles an hour ourselves. And we'd come 240,000 miles. We were aiming for a point 69 miles in front of a moving moon. It was one of the critical points of navigation was determining when you lost communication with the Earth, when the moon masked the radio waves from the Earth. And I was, again, totally impressed with the people on the ground, because at the exact second they said we would lose communication, we lost it. And, of course, we never saw the moon. We just were pointing the spacecraft on coordinates that had been given us from the ground. And firing it, I think we fired the spacecraft engine something like 4 minutes to slow down enough to get in lunar orbit. About halfway through that, or three quarters of the way through that, we looked down and there was the moon.
Can you describe for me that first impression of the lunar surface when you're suddenly so close?
We were, of course, on the far side of the moon. People on Earth often refer to that as the dark side, but that's incorrect. On our mission, the backside, or the far side, was illuminated more brilliantly from the sun than the side closest to the Earth. And the lunar surface was terribly distressed. with meteorites, holes, craters, volcanic residue. It was a very, very distressed place. And one of the things that struck me was there was absolutely no color. It was either gray or black or white. There was absolutely no color on the lunar surface.
Can you give me a sense of the appearance when you first saw the Earth from the moon? What was that moment? What happened?
On about the, I don't know, the fifth or sixth revolution, we looked up and there was the Earth in the background coming over the lunar surface. And Bill Anders took the picture that became a stamp, and I think it's probably one of the more significant pictures that humans had ever taken. But the contrast between the distressed moon and the beautiful blue Earth was remarkable. The Earth was the only thing in the entire universe that had any color. Basically blue. You could see the white clouds, the brownish-pink continents. It was a remarkable sight and a beautiful sight. We're very, very fortunate to live on this planet.
Can you just describe that moment where you saw the Earth? Were you expecting it?
No, as a matter of fact, I don't think any of us had paid any attention to the fact that we would be going all the way to the moon and be more interested in looking at the Earth. It was an unanticipated view, and it was dramatic.
It sounds like there was a scramble for the camera.
There was a scramble for the camera, and Bill Anders wanted. I took a picture too, but mine was black and white. And Bill used a 250-millimeter lens on his Hasselblad's camera to get that picture. Bill was really the chief photographer on the mission. He had studied it and he had all of his exposures planned.
Did you have any idea how powerful that image would be when the film was processed?
I did not have any idea how powerful it would be. All I knew was a beautiful Earth, and we were a long way from it.
What about at the time? Was there an emotional response to seeing that?
Well, there was an emotional response to it. I think the beauty of the Earth came through to all of us. And of course, as I said, we were a long way from home. It was Christmas, and everything that we held dear was back on Earth. So you had to have an emotional experience with that.
Can you describe then what you did on that TV broadcast on Christmas Eve?
Prior to the mission, I was informed that on Christmas Eve there would be a television broadcast from the moon and that we would have a larger audience than anybody had ever had before, any human had ever had before. And so I said, well, gee, Renee, that's interesting. What do we do? What's the plan? And I think it's one of the remarkable moments of a free country. The only instructions I got was do something appropriate. And that was, to me, can you imagine if the Soviets had been up there, we'd be talking about Lenin and Stalin and everybody else. This one was do something appropriate. And it sounds like that was an easy task. But the three of us and our wives tried to figure out what would be appropriate, and we couldn't. So I asked a close friend of mine, Cy Borgen, if he could come up with something. He was a sensitive, educated, intelligent man. He couldn't come up with anything. So he asked a friend of his, Joe Leighton, who was a war correspondent, had been a war correspondent. And Joe couldn't come up with anything. As I understand the story, he was sitting up all night throwing crumpled up paper away when his wife walked by, and his wife was a former French resistance fighter, free French fighter, and she suggested to him, why don't you start at the beginning, Genesis, and that's how it all happened. The first 10 verses of Genesis was everybody agreed, the crew, we didn't publicize it anywhere else, but the crew, everybody, all of us agreed that was It was the thing to do. And then, of course, while we were there and looking back at the moon and the Earth, I think it was the perfect thing to do.
Hey, why don't you start reading that thing, and then that would be a good place to end it. Well, we got to go into it very nicely. Why don't we just go into sunset?
Right.
Or is it sunrise? This is sunrise, yeah. We are approaching lunar sunrise.
We are now approaching lunar sunrise.
We started out with a little bit of a commentary on the lunar surface, what it looked like to each one of us. And then Bill Anders said, and the crew of Apollo 8 has a message. And we read from the 10 verses of the first 10 verses of Genesis.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from
and
the
darkness. And then I close with, from a crew of Apollo 8, good night, good luck, Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you.
All of you on the good earth. That's it. I don't see any more. I just turned it off. You want it on again?
Yeah, no, leave it off. Great.
Off?
Yeah.
Okay.
Camera's off?
Yep. Hey, how can you beat that? Jeez, we just went into the Terminator right in time.
Okay, let's get this thing straight back and even keel again. Here, here's this one.
How did you feel reading that? Because it packs an emotional punch listening to it.
We were quite convinced that it was the most appropriate thing to do because there's a sense of awe, in my part at least, that this universe is bigger than all of us. That there, it's too orderly and it's too enormous not to have some sort of divine creation.
Did it make you feel any differently about God and about creation?
Apollo 8 mission didn't change my attitude. I was a Christian before I left. I am a Christian today. I'm a believer that that man is a flawed individual and that our salvation depends upon Jesus Christ. That's the way I was before and that's the way I am now.
Did it make you think about our place in the universe at all?
No, I was concentrated on the moon and on our mission. This was the overwhelming. My main goal in this Apollo 8 flight was to make sure that we did it perfectly. If there anything went wrong, I didn't want the crew to be the ones that were to blame. So there was an enormous feeling on my part for perfection. And although I don't think anybody ever achieved perfection. Well, we accomplished all of our missions and came home safely. And I wasn't thinking about our place in the universe then. I was just thinking about getting back to the Earth in one piece.
How were you as a commander then?
Well, look, there were two good friends of mine on board. It was hardly a command situation. We were all oriented the same thing. We'd all trained together, and except for trying to get Anders and Lovell to take a rest once in a while, there wasn't much command involved in it. Everybody was doing their job and we were all on an equal status.
Now, the crucial moment comes when you need to leave lunar orbit. Can you just tell me the importance of that burn to get you out of the orbit of the moon?
Yes, the Earth orbit insertion burn was accomplished behind the moon, on the far side of the moon, out of touch of the ground. So we were on our own there, but we were given the coordinates to point the spacecraft at, and of course we'd done this many, many times in a simulator, and I won't say that was a moment of a lot of anticipation on my part, and I'm sure on Jim and Bill's too. It was quite a long burn. But again, it was smooth and quiet, and at the end of the burn, Jim Lovell, who was the navigator, basically announced that our velocity had increased enough so that we had a good burn and we were on our way home.
Was that a relief?
I suppose you could count it as a relief. As I said, there was a lot of anticipation, and it was a moment of the truth. As I said before, if that hadn't lit, we'd still be there. So there was certainly a moment of relief when we learned that we had had a good burn and we were on our way home.
Now, you spent Christmas as a crew on board the spacecraft. What was Christmas like?
Well, Christmas on board the spacecraft was a little bit different because Deke Slayton had anticipated Christmas dinner and put in food that was a new type of food packaging that we hadn't experienced before. So we had our best meal on the flight on Christmas Day and Christmas Eve. I had been against taking those, using that mood for that food for the whole flight, because it was just another opportunity to have something new go bad. But I was really glad to experience it. I think we had turkey and gravy, the whole works, on Christmas. He also smuggled aboard for us, didn't smuggle aboard, but put aboard three mission shots of brandy, but we didn't drink that. I would just absolutely, if anything had gone wrong, even if it had nothing to do with the brandy, that would be blamed. So we brought it home. I don't know what happened to mine. It's probably worth a lot of money now.
Do you get any sense when you're coming back from the moon of the speed you're going at towards Earth?
You don't get the sense of motion until you get closer to the Earth, and then you can see that the Earth is getting larger. From the moon, you could hold out our arm and cover the Earth with our thumbnail. But then as you got closer and closer, of course, it became larger and larger, occupied more of the windshield. So there is really no sensation of velocity or speed in space, except as you get close to something for a reference.
When you commit to re-entering the Earth's atmosphere, what's that moment like, and what is re-entry like? Because you were going faster than anyone ever before.
We were going faster, around 25,000 miles an hour, and we positioned the spacecraft according to the way we had been trained. And what happened, the spacecraft dug into the atmosphere. It had lift, even though it had no wings. And then in order to, when it came to the maximum G in thermal load, it started back out again. And then before you escaped the atmosphere, you rolled over 180 degrees and then came back in. Typically, when you're going around the Earth, you fire a retro rocket to slow down. Here we use the atmosphere to slow us down. So it was from a physical standpoint, it was the most arduous part of the mission because you're pulling 6 Gs for quite a long time. It gets hard to breathe. I'd like to tell you that was superior piloting on my part, but it was all done on the autopilot.
Do you still recall that what that was like coming back into Earth?
I do recall it because not only are you pulling a lot of Gs, but when you encounter the atmosphere, you ionize it, and it was like flying inside of a neon light or a blowtorch. It was the most dramatic part of the flight.
And you descend then on parachutes. What's it like when you hit the ocean and immediately afterwards?
Well, I think around 100,000 feet, you pull out, or 30,000 feet, I can't remember exactly, you put out a drogue chute. That helps us keep you from oscillating. And then around 10,000 feet, three big parachutes came out. We were landing before sunrise, so it was hard for us to tell whether they had gone out or not, but our rate of descent slowed considerably. And when we hit the water, we did it with an enormous whack. I guess we must have hit a swell. And the parachutes tipped us over. So by the time I got them released, we were floating upside down in total darkness in the Pacific Ocean, going around and around and up and down.
And there were sharks as well, I think.
We were floating upside down in perfect darkness. But NASA had a solution for that, too. I pushed a switch, and an air compressor inflated three large balloons, and we popped back right up again. But the spacecraft was still a lousy boat, and we had to wait about 2 hours till daylight because the Navy didn't want to put divers in when there were sharks around.
What was that part like? Because you were not a Navy man.
No, and as I said, the Apollo was a beautiful spacecraft and a rotten boat Because not only were you going like this, but it's going around a little bit too. So I got seasick and threw up all over Anders and Lovell. And I still hear about that to the day.
What was that like then when you finally get to open the spacecraft hatch?
I think one of the most joyous parts of anybody's life is doing a job well. And when we stepped off the helicopter onto the aircraft carrier with the sailors cheering and the flag waving, it was a remarkable feeling of humility, but yet of accomplishment.
And is it right that you also shaved on the way from the space capsule to the deck, so you looked smart?
I did. On our Gemini flight of 2 weeks, I don't have a very good beard, scraggly beard, and I took a big ribbing for a long time about that. So I got one of the helicopter people to bring an electric shaver for me. So I stepped off looking fresh. Anders and Lovell looked bedeviled.
Just in terms of the mission itself, and obviously, you know, the mission went perfectly. What did that mean for the Apollo program?
Well, Apollo 8, as I said, together with all the other preliminary flights, were very, very important to keeping the commitment of the president to do it before the end of the decade. This was basically a battle in the Cold War, and it had enormous consequences. So there was a lot of pressure. There was a lot of anguish. It was a great place to work, NASA at that time was, because nothing really mattered but the mission. And the mission came first, last and always. So I am still in admiration for the people, not just the astronauts. We got most of the credit. But there were 400,000 people that made that work. And I was very, very proud of them.
At what point did you realize the significance of those pictures you'd captured and the lasting legacy of Apollo 8?
I've never thought much about it because, as I said, it wasn't just an individual flight that made the difference. It was a sequence of flights, and it was a great accomplishment by an awful lot of people who sacrificed an awful lot of their personal lives to make sure this worked.
In terms of the Earthrise picture, it has lasted. Do you think about that was, you know, something that you helped achieve?
To be honest with you, I don't really think about the legacy of Apollo 8. The preliminary flights got the ball into the red zone, close to the goal line in American football. But Apollo 11 took it over the goal, and that was the focus point of it. And frankly, after Apollo 11 was successful, I had no more interest in the program. I'd joined to help fight a battle in the Cold War, and we'd won.
At what point did you decide this would be your last mission?
Well, as I said, I had joined NASA to participate in the Cold War efforts to beat the Russians or the Soviets. And it was clear to me that Apollo 8 was successful. As a matter of fact, I was asking the press conference after we got back, when would the lunar landing take place? I said in Apollo 11. And there's no way that I was going to be able to rotate from 8 to 11. I had never been in a lunar module simulator, so I hadn't done the training for it. And I wasn't anxious. Like Jim Lovell was very anxious to do it again, and he went on Apollo 13. But I'd done my task, and it's time to move on.
What do you think of NASA's plans to return to the moon?
I haven't kept close touch of it, but I believe it makes a lot more sense than trying to go to the Mars directly without having some experience in habitation on a foreign object.
Do you have a sense of frustration that it's taken so long? I mean, 50 years to start thinking about going back.
No, I don't have any sense of frustration about going back. I think human beings will, I hope they will always continue to press the envelope, expand the envelope. But, you know, going to Mars is infinitely more difficult than going to the moon. And not only that, then trying to exist on Mars is also much more difficult than the Moon. When these people talk about colonizing the Mars, I think your Stephen Hawking was talking about. I don't believe that they've taken into account the difficulties the human being would have trying to exist, let alone a civilization on Mars. So I think there may be one time a scientific output there, like that you have at the South Pole, but I don't believe that Mars will ever be colonized by humans.
As part of the crew of the first crew to go to the Moon, what would be your advice to any astronauts going back? Is there anything you think they should must do or must think about?
You know, I wouldn't be... I'm an old geezer now, 90 years old. I wouldn't have the temerity to offer any advice to these young people that know everything.
Any advice to them about, maybe just about achievement?
My advice to any youngster is to do your best in whatever you've done and to be willing and actually anxious to subordinate your own desires to the good of the mission that you're involved in. We did our job. We did it well. We won the race.
Colonel Frank Borman, who died earlier this month at the age of 95. Initial thoughts?
I really liked it. I think the typical sort of astronaut no-nonsense stuff came through. And that sort of paucity of words to describe something that could be really, really bad, sort of along the lines of Houston, we have a problem. I think it was that way. When you said about the question about, you know, there was no way of landing while you were up in the service propulsion module.
Could have been stuck in orbit around the moon.
I'd still be circling around the moon. And he said, that's not a desirable effect. That's like something a computer would say.
Well, I think, you know, the fact he just described himself as a Cold War warrior. I mean, that was it. You know, he was in this war.
Mm-mm.
That was his contribution to the war, and that was it when he'd finished the mission, you know.
Yeah, no, it was, I also quite, it was pretty obvious that how little regard he had for the doctors. And I know that's common
Brilliant.
About all the astronauts at that time, because they saw them as the enemy, because they could ground them, they could stop their dreams, they could prevent their progress from test pilot to astronaut. But he really sounded stupid. He was so dismissive. God, trying to assume a position more important than they really deserved. I mean, you. So, And I like the term barbecuing. I'd not heard that before.
Yes, he had a really nice
rolling
turn
up
of
space craft
phrase. I mean, considering it was so long ago when he'd taken part in that mission, it was also vivid.
Yes.
But very straight down the line. Now, he doesn't laugh much in the interview, but I just wanted to... I think I explained at the beginning how we had the hearing issues.
Yes.
So partly his fault, partly the line, partly the tech setup, which was really complicated, which I won't go into the detail. But at one point, he couldn't hear us. And let me just play you a clip.
Oh, okay.
Feel okay?
I'm sorry, the earpiece fell out of my ear and I didn't know it.
That's quite all right.
That one wasn't your fault, but the rest of them have been.
Look, we're not NASA, we're just the BBC.
See, look, I made him laugh.
We've talked about the appearance of the moon.
I made him laugh.
I also like that bit when he said, I never thought I would be going to the moon and be more interested in looking at the Earth.
Mm.
I like that bit as well. And my other thing that I cannot help but wonder, and I really want to know the answer to, is what became of that untouched brandy?
Yeah, like he says, that would be worth
a
fortune.
Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine?
Someone must have it. I mean, someone must have taken it.
Oh, maybe what somebody did was just bring it down and drink it, you know, and then regret it.
You can understand that. You know, he flew. They flew a perfect mission.
Mm.
And really, you know, on paper, risky mission in an untried rocket. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Well,
and it shows the pressure the whole program was under and the pressure to win the program to get there first. And so you can understand why they didn't want to drink. You know,
Yes. But also you could understand why they got test pilots, because you need that that right stuff, that attitude of, yeah, I'm going to do something dangerous, what of it? You know, obviously it's calculated risk. I'm not sure any of those men had a death wish, for instance, but it was a calculated risk, and they're incredibly brave. It's lovely. I think that's a really great tribute.
Yeah, really,
to Frank Borman.
Really pleased to have that.
And nice to have a full, long-length interview with him. That is, as we said, that's a bit of an exclusive. No one's heard that interview before in its entirety, and it's a shame we had to wait for his death to play it. But that's a tribute. There's a tribute.
It's funny. It only occurred to me that I thought, hang on, I might have the whole interview somewhere and never actually used it. Because what we did, the way these things work technically, as you know, we record both ends of the interview. So we were connected. I think it was Skype. At the time, I think it was Skype, something like that. We were connected.
Which you don't normally use Skype.
No, it was pre-Zoom.
Oh, and also was it pre-pandemic then?
Yeah, pre-pandemic,
it's
pre-Zoom.
It's funny, we've changed now, haven't you, in terms of what...
Yeah,
what
so I think it was connected with Skype. And so I could see him, and that was all the sound issues as well. So he had this earpiece, which, as you heard fell out every so often. So you had this setup, but we recorded at both ends. So had a sound engineer at the other end recording his answers, and I was recording my questions in the BBC studio. And there was never any necessity to hear my questions.
No.
In the programmes I made, or the TV content we also produced from that, we never needed my questions. So I never stitched the two sides of the interview together.
I think we better stress as well, you know, in case anybody listening from the BBC thinks, hold on, what are you doing using other...
it was our programme.
It was our programme. We paid for half of that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I paid for that. Oh, you have no idea how expensive American sound engineers in Montana are.
I can have a pretty good guess, having had to pay for them for other programs.
When I received his bill, I went,
oh my goodness!
Yes,
I think I don't think America realizes, do they,
how cheap we are,
and how little anybody gets paid compared to Americans.
It's
a different world,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's why so many UK podcast production houses are based in the UK and not the US.
Yes.
Yeah. By the way, that award-winning program I made about Apollo 8 and astronauts. It's actually about astronauts and religion. It's called Message from the Moon. It's still available on BBC Sounds and the BBC website. The two versions. My favourite is the Radio 3 version because it doesn't have a presenter. It's just music and the astronauts and lots of the sounds of the mission. You can find that by Googling Message from the Moon BBC Radio 3. That's very much slower, shouldn't I? BBC Radio 3.
Yes.
And then just leave a gap.
Only UK listeners will get that. Only UK listeners will get that about the nature of Radio 3, where a four-minute pause is the norm.
Yes.
Right. Do get in touch with any thoughts about Space Boffins and especially the Frank Borman interview. You can email us podcast@spaceboffins.com or get in touch with us here at Boffin Media. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook.
Facebook than Twitter now broken.
Twitter is broken, isn't it? I find it difficult. People that we've been following, it's just like you don't see their feeds anymore. We follow loads of space content. Where's it gone? It's a bit of a crazy, crazy world at the moment. And I suppose all we can say is let's hope that 2024 is going to be a more globally peaceful one than 2023.
I think we'll do some space looking ahead in January because Artemis.
Oh, yes. And also we'll, fingers crossed, have a report on moonwalkers and an interview with Chris Riley.
Oh, yeah, we will, won't we?
Yeah.
So we're
going to see that in early Jan.
Yeah,
so, that'll be really good fun. And that's based on... uses a lot of the images that were digitally remastered by Andy Saunders, who you can also hear on a previous podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, check us out.
Thanks for listening.